You're listening to Crime Friction, a show about guava.
And sometimes mango. So, Jay, I know that you don't want to talk about this, but you just found a home for your totally awesome female Indiana Jones-esque historical globe-trotting adventure.
Yeah, so I've got a 2-book deal with Pegasus Books. I'm really excited. I can't wait to work with them with this character that's got a name that's going to be mispronounced by everybody, which is my fault, apparently. That's how I write characters. So, Marat Chase and the Conqueror's Tomb. Fun fact, I also can't spell Conqueror. So it's got a name that people can't pronounce and a word that I can't spell. I don't know about you, but there's a weird thing I find with publishing, which is I have more than one taste. There's more than one version of me when it comes to stories that I want to tell. Sometimes I want to be, you know, Elmore Leonard. Sometimes I want to be the French Connection. Sometimes I want to blow shit up and be crazy and, you know, be a bit Spielberg-y and just have fun. But publishers kind of need you to be a marketable thing that they can sell, which is understandable. But sometimes it means you can be sitting on books that you can't have a home for, because I've published 5 books in a row that essentially are PI novels to one degree or another. You know, and some have been dark and some have been funny. But that's kind of what I've been known for. But this whole time I've been writing these other books that are crazy and are full of explosions and car chases and are kind of love letters to Raiders of the Lost Ark and James Bond and Mission Impossible, but with a gay woman as the lead character. And it's publishing, it's really difficult to be both. You've got to be one thing. You can't be two things. And that's weird and that's frustrating.
So there's no reason why a writer can't have different hats and why they have to be pigeonholed into one sort of thing.
Yeah, and I do understand the marketing point of view, because you know, publishers, I think, do feel like they're competing for attention. They do feel like they've maybe got one chance to get your name known, and so it's got to be a brand. And I completely understand that, and I try and cooperate with that as much as I can. And my cats try and fight. And I do understand that, and I do.
Oh my god, that sounded like a human that you fucking punched in the face.
No, that was Scooter. I'm professional. I'll work with publishers. I cooperate and play the game, and I want them to sell. But it is. I think it can sometimes be weird thinking. It's received wisdom, and I don't know how often we test that. How often we try and let authors do different things and be more than one flavor.
I think that's a flaw in the traditional publishing marketing plan, because I would like an author who appeals to a wide variety of audiences and genres, because I'm just increasing the Venn diagram where, you know, my work can be seen. So if you just keep doing the same thing, then you're just hitting the same note and you're not growing your audience per se. So having these different opportunities and trying different things, you have wider audiences and wider people that can see your work.
And it made me a better writer. I think it would for everyone else to be able to do different things like that, to be able to play in different toolboxes, because, I mean, my crime books, certainly the ones that are out, the ones that people can go and buy right now, please go and buy them, the ones that people can go and buy right now in the shops, if you read them in order, I think you can see me trying to learn how to play with subtext in a book. You can see me trying to figure out where the line is, you know, and in some books it's more apparent, in some books it's more hidden. But then going and writing what is just effectively a huge action thriller film type Hollywood blockbuster thing, I took a different approach to subtext. So I took a massive, massive step back. And the subtext, it's all broad strokes. I'm still making a lot of the same points and I'm writing about the same issues, but just in very, very, very broad strokes that apply to a Hollywood blockbuster. And then I found when I started writing crime novels again afterwards, I realized I could take the same approach, but I feel like those books are more universal and that more people would read them because I found this new balance through writing a different genre. The other thing I learned doing this, and I don't have to say I learned it, I've always known it, but what I was reminded of doing it through this process as well is something that I think it can be easy to lose sight of when you're out of contract, or if you're listening and you don't have a book deal yet, you've never had one, and you're worried about how finding one, finding the right publisher, which offers you should take. For me, ultimately, it came down to which editor, which house I knew had got what I was doing. A lot of people were reading it, a lot of people were enjoying it. There's diversity in the book, and I've deliberately tried to present a traditional Indiana Jonesy action pulp style story, but with modern sensibilities and with modern diversity. And a lot of people reading it, enjoying it, but then we're kind of thinking, oh, I don't know if we can sell it. I don't know if we can market it. I'm not sure what the audience is. And for me, when I saw an editor who instantly got it and instantly explained it to me and my agent the way that I would have been explaining it to someone else, that's when you think that's the right home for this book. And if you're out there, if you've not got an agent, or if you've got an agent but you're struggling to find a publisher, just don't worry about it and keep going, because at some point you're going to hear from someone who says the right thing, who gets the project, and that's the home for the book. Whether that's an agent and it's the right agent, or whether it's a publisher and it's the right publisher, that's the home for you in that book, and you will find it. And trust it. Trust your gut on that.
Well, but I talk about rejection a lot because it's hard. I mean, just as a human, it happens every day in some way, shape, or form. But when it's your book, it's so much more emotional and so much more affecting than it is anything else. And the thing is that you find the right home. It might be, the first five people that you think are really great agents or really great publishers, and they're going to pass on it, and you're going to feel really bad about it. And that's okay as far as emotion goes. But you also, from a business standpoint, that's not the person you want representing or giving a home to your work. You want the person who is as passionate, who read it and couldn't wait, to get the next installment or had to stay up all night. You want somebody that's as passionate about your work as you are. And that's going to be the person who makes it most successful. So those initial rejections aren't as important as you think they are, because you're waiting for the person who can really do it justice and cares about it like you do.
Because it's all it is ultimately it's a business. It is a business. It's we're in show I always say that we're in show business, and both of those words matter, and in that order. So we're in business, and you're going to be talking to editors and agents and publishers and marketing people. You're going to be talking to people who are correctly looking at the business point of view, because that's their job. They've got to make money off it, just the same as you've got to make money off it. You need to pay the bills with this. That we don't need to, but look at it that this thing hopefully will pay your bills, so you have to think about the business. But ultimately, it does have to come down to the person who's going to do the best version of that for you, the person who's going to stand the best chance of engaging that project with other people, is the one who's most engaged in it. And so just wait for that voice and wait for that person, and then go with them.
So our guest this week is somebody who has assembled a great team. Rob Hart is the author of the Ash McKenna series, published by Polis Books, which will wrap up in July 2018 with Potter's Field. Previous entries in the series include New York, which was nominated for an Anthony Award for Best First Novel, City of Rose, South Village, and The Woman from Prague. He also co-wrote Scot Free with James Patterson. In January 2019, his first short story collection, Takeout, will be released by Polis Books. Later in the year, his first standalone novel, The Warehouse, will be released by Crown at Random House. The Warehouse has sold in more than a dozen countries and has been optioned for film by Ron Howard. By day, Rob is the publisher at MysteriousPress.com and the class director at Lit Reactor. Hey Jay, what do you say we call our guest now?
How do you add people into a call again?
I
do you
don't
remember?
know that I've never done it. You always do this.
Like, there's usually a little option at the bottom that says add someone in, and I can't see it.
Okay, so
I have a dial pad.
And you know, I almost, because when I typed in Rob, like more than one Rob came up, and it would be really funny if we called the wrong one sometime and left it in, like, sorry, wrong number.
All right, I'm going to press call.
We're going to talk about how, like, we hate him because he's watching the beautiful ocean.
This is true.
Hey, Rob.
I am looking at the beautiful ocean right now.
Yeah. I hope you caught the first part where we're like, yeah, we just hate him. He's doing this right now.
Yeah, no, I did get that, so thank you.
You're very welcome.
I'm looking at Glaswegian rubbish bins. It's pretty similar.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found a bar that was open, and I got myself a margarita, and I'm doing okay.
Okay, so you totally have to do a photo of the margaritas so we can attach it to the show notes.
I'm going to do that right now, because otherwise I'm going to drink it, and then it won't be as compelling.
Just an empty glass. Just line them up. Like this.
Then
is
that
the
just
beginning.
Looks like you've got a problem.
Yeah, it's pretty nice down here. Hawaii is not bad.
So, you know, inquiring minds want to know about that barbecue next to the, like, grocery store.
Oh, yeah. So I found this on, like, on a website, like, a good, like, good places to go to eat in Hawaii, and... Yeah, it was like this super sketchy place, but it was like great, like plate lunch Korean barbecue. And they had this, it's called Meat Jun, and it's like very, very, very thin slices of meat with like an egg batter on them. And it's really weird. And it's not like anything I've ever had before, but it was really good. And like really good barbecue chicken. But like, you're basically like walking into the loading bay of a supermarket to order your food. And then you sit there and it's like, hey, this food goes really well with the exhaust fume.
I feel like that sort of website that you're referencing is one where they lull you into a false sense of security. So like the first two, you're not going to die. And then the third one, it's like, you know, black market organs. Like, we've convinced him to walk up the ramp, the deserted supermarket ramp, because he's gotten good food there twice. So time three, he's not even going to question when we have him go into the walk-in freezer.
I think you always question, you know, going into a walk-in freezer. I think there's no scenario when you don't question that.
No, I probably wouldn't question it, but I'm also not that smart. And I also like to eat. So if someone tells me, hey, if you go in there, you're going to get a really good sandwich, I'm going to be like, fuck yes, this is the internet. You must be right.
It's like me with the van of puppies that's spelled with one P and the P is backwards.
Exactly. It's like, how could you say no to puppies? It would be stupid to say no.
Anytime I'm given directions, I react like I'm in Goodfellas, and it's Robert De Niro just telling me to, like, go a bit further, just down there. And my brain's just instantly like, no, you're going to kill me. No. So when you're in Hawaii, have you run into Magnum PI yet?
No. It's actually, we've mostly been on the resort, so I've mostly been running into, like, white tourists.
I had a friend at my old job, my day job, and we were talking once about where we wanted to travel in the world. And I said, you know, one day I've got to go to Egypt at some point. I have to go to Egypt. And he got really excited and he's like, okay. Yeah, you've got to go to Egypt. And I was thinking that he was going to be like, yeah, the pyramids, the Sphinx. And he's like, man, the McDonald's in Egypt is the best McDonald's anywhere in the world. And I was like, are you kidding me? There's a big pyramid thing right over there.
Okay, well, so this is kind of an interesting point, because like, fast food places like McDonald's outside of America have like weird local shit that you can't get. And so I'm always fascinated with food when I travel, and not just like really good restaurants, but like I like to go to grocery stores when I'm in another country.
Oh yeah. Grocery stores are absolutely the best. I see crazy things, half of which I don't know what they are because I might not read the language. I just got back from Asia and discovered that seaweed has flavor, which a lot of you probably know, but I didn't know. And the grocery stores, the biggest snack is seaweed snacks, right? Which I discovered like day one, and then packed, like bought as many as I possibly could smuggle back into the country.
Yeah, no, I was in Singapore recently, and it was just like, I went into the grocery store and I was like, what the fuck is any of this? And it was so exciting because it's like playing chicken with your gastrointestinal tract.
Yeah.
That's a good rule for life. I don't really care about what I'm eating. I mean, we have some food over here that's made of really disgusting stuff if you think about it, but I don't care. It tastes good.
Yeah.
When I was little, I went to Hawaii with my parents. And the thing that I remember most about this was they had fresh guava juice in Hawaii. And it was the most delicious thing I've ever had in my life. And no matter what, you know, we have that sugary shit that fakes it in the States. And I've never been able to recreate that taste or that feeling. And please tell me that you have had fresh guava juice while you've been in Hawaii, and describe everything it tastes like.
I have not, but what I did have is, my friend who was getting married, he had like welcome drinks at a bar last night, and they got donuts from this, they're like donuts, they're not really donuts, they're called something else, but from this place called Leonard's, that's like this really famous place in Hawaii.
That sounds very Hawaiian, Leonard's Donuts.
It does. And they had like, they're more like, they're donuts without holes in them. They're just like big, like balls of fried dough. But one had like a guava cream in it that was just really, really incredible. But that's the closest I've gotten to guava so far. I've had a bunch of pineapple. I don't know if pineapple is indigenous to here. And supposedly mango is really good, but we went to Target yesterday to buy some groceries and they didn't have any mango. And I was like, well, that's some bullshit.
Yeah, see, I'm not a mango person. They had a lot of fresh mango in Thailand. That was the deal there. And guava is not indigenous to Thailand, but it was brought over long enough ago. But interestingly, and we can cut all of this out because it's the most boring podcast ever in the history of the world, but Hawaiian guava is pink, and Thai guava is green. And one is a little
weird.
Bit more kiwi flavored than the other. So they've like actually like developed separate strands, indigenous, I believe, to neither place. But another fun fact about guava and Thailand is that in Thai, the word guava, and I'm going to totally mispronounce this, but it's called pharang, which is also the name for a foreigner or tourist. So basically, if you ever watch Deep Space Nine, like pharangi, because neither thing is indigenous to the country. And I'm like, wow, that's really inside baseball.
So how long did you spend Wikipedia-ing all of this?
Yeah, right?
Like the first second they gave me a glass of guava juice and I'm like, is this indigenous to this country? 5 hours later, I reemerged. I was like, oh, I missed a day of tourism because I was looking at guavas.
But now you've got the JFK assassination all figured out.
Exactly.
Like you
I do that with research a lot when I'm like working on book stuff and like you just get sucked into things and all of a sudden you're reading about something that has nothing to do with it. But you're like, yeah, fuck it. I'm still learning something. I'll use it eventually.
Yeah, and then you get stuck there, and you're like, well, the book has to be about this now. Fuck it.
So I don't know if there's anything that we need to talk about that we can couch in a accidental segue from guavas to. Les Edgerton just did a interview, and I forget where it was. I read it yesterday, and we can find it and put it in the show notes and pretend like I know what I'm talking about. But he gave praise to, but also called out Lee Child as one of the, and I'm going to misquote, but again, we'll put the actual article in there and it'll all make sense. Lee Child as one of the obviously biggest and best known names, but doing completely different work from what he's doing because he claimed that Lee Child had, you know, cracked the marketability code. And it wasn't really an attempt to, I don't want to say change the genre or transcend the genre or create something new and different that makes you look at the world a different way. It was just like, this is fun, this is marketable, and I can do this. And he said there's two different types of writing. One, whether or not you agree, is his, according to him. And then, you know, this other thing falls into this different category. But the way he said it, which might sound pretentious, wasn't really. It was just more like we have different goals with what we want to do with our writing. And we've cracked the code in two different ways. And there's no better and there's no worse. It all belongs out there, you know, as long as it's quality.
I agree with that and I disagree with that. And and I mostly agree with that in that I believe that, yes, there is a code. I spent like the last year and a half, 2 years, and I think it kind of played out with The Warehouse, which was I started reading a lot more very marketable commercial thrillers because I wanted to kind of figure out like what it was about them that made that set them apart, that made them so readable and so saleable. I got a lot of really good stuff out of that, and it was a very worthwhile thing for me to do. The only point where I kind of disagree is I feel like there's this backhanded, like sticking your pinky in the air, like, you know, well, I'm a real artiste, so I don't write like Lee Child, but I guess he's okay. And that I'm not totally down with because like first off, you know, Lee is doing what Lee does, and he does it well, and he's successful, and good on him. That's fucking great. It's different.
I think that's the point, and I think that's part of the problem. And that's why I'm saying you have to recognize what path you want and not knock the ones that you don't choose or don't fit into. Because there's, as I've said ad nauseum, this is all subjective. And so, you know, somebody who thinks that Lee Child is the height of literary fiction might, you know, disagree with somebody else who believes it doesn't really matter. These distinctions don't matter. It's all writing and it's all achieving the same goal. So there's no better than or less than.
I think I'm the same as Rob in that I agree and disagree with his idea, with Les's idea. I mean, firstly, that there absolutely are those different paths that you can take, and you need to decide which path you're on, and as you guys have both said, and not hold the other path against the other writers if it leads to more sales for them. Just pick your path, learn the craft, get better at it, and move on. But the thing I learned doing stand-up is that you can stand at the back of the room and say, you know, my stuff's too niche, the crowd don't get it. But there are people who could go and do niche stuff and still learn how to kill the room. It's still ultimately about connecting with the audience and finding ways to do it, whether that means doing something quite big and broad and mainstream and learning to connect with that, or doing something niche and still putting in the work to connect with your audience, whether it be viewers or readers. And I do sometimes think that there are authors in our community who deliberately put up barriers to doing that by making it about some kind of arty statement. Oh, I'm not going to reach those readers, and just think, well, you can be niche and still put in the work to connect with people, and stop creating excuses to not do it.
You know, I think a lot of people don't really think about that. They don't think about connecting with the audience. They think that, hold on a second, my daughter is yelling to me. Hi, Abby.
She should totally be on this podcast.
I completely lost track of what we were talking about. So, you know, there's this, and I think this is one of the things that I learned in looking at commercial thrillers, is like sort of keeping the audience in mind. And this is something that I'm really seeing right now as I'm working on the edits for The Warehouse, is there's a lot of times where I threw in like a little flourish or a little something that I thought was like kind of interesting. And my editor is like, nope, take that out. That's awkward. Or take that out. That doesn't work. And it's like, oh yeah, because that was for me. That was not for the reader, you know? And it's sort of like, it's sort of like what Elmore Leonard said about taking out all the parts that sound like writing. Yep. You know, there's a way to, there's a balance you can find between writing something well, but also making sure it's readable. And that's a hard balance to find. And it's, I think that's, once you find that balance, is when you sort of like, you crack the code.
So this week's sponsor is Potter's Field by Polis Books. Named one of the best mysteries of the summer by the Star Tribune, it's the final entry in the Ash McKenna Private Investigator series. After more than a year on the road, he's ready to face the demons he ran away from in New York City. He's decided what he wants to do with his life: become an investigator for real, licensed and everything. No more working as a thug for hire. But within moments of stepping off the plane, the drag queen crime lord who once employed him and then tried to have him killed asked to see him. Visit this last installment of the Ash McKenna series, out July 10th.
Back to Rob.
Oh man, and that's just a longer conversation, but it's sort of like that weird, like, everyone's kind of like weird about the end of Infinity War because they don't understand how like mainstream storytelling works, which is kind of weird. But, you know, I feel like it's very easy to like watch that movie and go, oh yes, like obviously there's going to be a big course correction, and obviously a lot of these things aren't going to stick. I'm not a big fan of the argument that the only stake is whether a character lives or dies. I think stakes have to be emotional. And whether a character achieves what they're looking for, or they become the person that they want to be, like, those are stakes that matter. Like, the fact that a person dies, like, that's kind of nonsense. And in, like, 95% of mainstream storytelling, the main character's not going to die anyway. So it's like, what are you waiting for? Mm-hmm. It's like, people are like, oh, I can't get involved in, like, a Captain America movie because I know Captain America's not going to die at the end. And it's like, okay, that's compared to, like, every other blockbuster film where the characters do die at the end, like, which does happen sometimes, but rarely, where the main character dies. I sometimes get weirded out at how people respond to fiction. And, like, as a writer, it kind of freaks me out. Cause it's like how are you not kind of seeing how the wheels turn on this?
Yeah.
You know?
And death can become pointless, can become meaningless, even in a story that's well done. I mean, past a certain point in Die Hard, it doesn't matter whether John McClane lives or dies, because we know he's willing to die to save his wife.
If anyone saw Rogue One, the only reason, and spoiler alert here, the only reason that movie worked is because all of the characters died at the end. And I kind of thought that was a really brave thing to do storytelling wise because unlike Infinity War, where we had this suspension of disbelief, if you got into it enough, you might think some of these characters were going to stay dead, right? Rogue One, we didn't know who the hell they were. You know, they were new backstory characters, so there wasn't that suspension, and they actually killed them off, and I went, that movie would not have worked. And I didn't like it until they killed them off, because it was what was necessary for the characters, and it was a bigger stake than I live or die.
It was a ballsy play, because I think what they did is, and, you know, I generally like the movie. I mean, it was definitely, you can kind of feel that there were a lot of hands on it, and they made a lot of changes in post where, like, sometimes the connective tissue wasn't there. But I think what they did, which is really good, is they made you care enough about the characters that by the time you get to the end, you're like, I know they're all going to die, but, like, I really don't want them to. And then when they do, you're like, fuck, I knew that was coming, but that's kind of a bummer. And I think that was a huge success of theirs in that they got you invested enough. And it wasn't that they got you invested in whether or not they lived or died. It got you invested in who they were as people. You know, which was kind of the difference. Like, it wasn't about that binary, because you already knew what the answer was. You know, so why would you give a fuck if you don't care about them?
Yeah. So it's, you know, life or death is not the only stake to exist. And I think that's the mistake that people make with Infinity War.
It's like the question for me when I walked out of that movie wasn't like, oh, my God, I can't believe Spider-Man said, oh, my God, I can't believe Black Panther said. It's like, how are they going to get themselves out of this one? Because obviously they're going to. Like, Black Panther is a humongous franchise. They're not just going to kill off that character before the sequel comes out. Like, I'm sure they're planning, like, to make 20 of those movies. So I'm very interested to know. And I spent, like, a good amount of time wondering, like, you know, how are they going to fix this? And I have theories on it. Like, I'm sitting there, like, thinking about it. And I'm still actively engaged in the story after the story is over, which is really exciting. It's like, oh, they did something here that's really cool. It's they're keeping me invested even after I left the theater.
So you see, we had a plan, Rob.
No, this is, I mean, look, you know, I wasn't looking for anything too structured or intense. Again, I am sitting on a beach drinking a margarita.
Why the hell would
so,
we want to have
I mean,
a podcast it, if it was too structured or intense? I mean, we do that shit in real life. Let's just talk about things. And what
it's
would
also
you...
like, if you had asked me to bring my A game, like, you're not getting it today. You're getting my B-plus game. I'm
but that's
on
the best game.
I have a B-plus game question. Because that's probably where I do my best thinking is when I'm at about B-plus. When
absolutely.
I'm A, I get like... No, when I'm at B, that's me fluting, not highfalutin. That's me about right. So I mentioned this to Chantal earlier on that I think... The most important Hollywood director of the 1970s was Steven Spielberg, not Martin Scorsese.
Okay.
Well, Scorsese made
I don't have a rebuttal.
I'm just going to see if everyone agrees. But Scorsese made great films, but he's the one, like, when I was a film student in my brief career as a student, like, Scorsese was the one that was cool to like, and he did make great films. Like, I mean, Taxi Driver is a great film. Raging Bull is a great film. I don't need to watch them that often. But when Spielberg was making Jaws and Close Encounters and those 70s films that were full of subtext and messages, but they were entertaining and they were fun, and you can watch them and watch them and watch them and watch them, I think that's a better director. That's a more effective director than Raging Bull and Taxi Driver.
This was more of a stray thought, but, you know, I was really taken aback when Ready Player One was coming out. Because, like, I know some people feel strongly about that book in ways that are not overwhelmingly positive. And people are like, I can't believe it. This is going to be such a bad movie. Why is Spielberg doing this? And it's like, how the fuck do you not give Spielberg the benefit of the doubt by this point? Like, Spielberg can say, I'm going to make a movie in which an old man runs into a wall for 90 minutes, and I'm going to be like, I'll see it, you know, because it's fucking Spielberg, and he got the pass. Because, you know, even his bad movies, like Hook, are, like, decently watchable. But his best movies are going to go down as some of the greatest movies ever made. So, you know, I'm not getting too worried about his output.
Call me ignorant, call me clueless. Maybe I just don't have the emotional depth of most people. But I enjoyed the hell out of Ready Player One as a book because I grew up in the 80s and this was all things that I related to. I saw nothing about gender roles. I just saw this was a lot of callbacks about games and music and movies that I'd seen and I was excited. Whether or not the movie, I haven't seen the movie, is anything similar to or has any underlying themes that I did not think about thinking about, no clue. So that's that. But then when we go to Jay's point, it goes back to something we talk about a lot where it's not necessarily, you know, there are good movies, there are great movies, and then there are movies I enjoy. And that Venn diagram may or may not overlap. There are, you know, Taxi Driver, like you said, Jay, great movie. I don't know that I want to come home after a bad day and watch it five more times. Or if I do, I should probably be, you know, on a watch list. But there are things that sustain, that entertain me, which I think is the difference between a book and a movie. In a lot of ways. And then there are the things where I go to that I want to feel a different thing or explore a condition or something other than me.
You know what movie I will always watch if I'm clicking through the channels and it's on is Catch Me If You Can. Like, I fucking love that movie because it's like, it's kind of light, you know, it's a fun movie, it's fast moving, it's like, it's about a con man, which is just always an interesting subject, but like, it's a fun fucking movie, you know. I don't know if like Taxi Driver is not the kind of movie that like I would be flicking through the channels and see it and be like, yes, I would like to finish watching this movie, because right. Then if I did, I would just feel bad by the end.
It does feel like at some point Hollywood split over it, that there were films in the 70s and 60s, 70s, 80s. There were films that would be both. There were films that would be entertaining and have some extra substance to them, and then for some reason, so then we get to the 90s when Spielberg suddenly he'll make Jurassic Park and Schindler's List back to back, and then the following two he'll then make The Lost World and Amistad back to back, and somewhere along the way the two paths diverged a bit, almost like we're talking about the two writer paths, you know. There's almost like Hollywood kind of went, we can have worthy films and we can have fun films, but we can't mix the two.
If you look back at sort of like the pantheon of literature, I mean, some of the best, most like influential pieces of fiction were genre fiction. 1984 and Fahrenheit 451. And you know, these books that really sort of made people think about this stuff were thrillers. You know, Fahrenheit 451 is kind of a thriller. And it's like a pulpy sci-fi cool book. And it also like, I mean, for me personally, it completely changed the way that I look at books. And, you know, I think there's almost this hesitancy to give thrillers too much credit because, you know, you don't want to. And again, this kind of goes back to that, like, I'm an artiste thing. And I think it's sort of, there's this inherent bitterness in the writing world. And people get infected by it or they don't get infected by it. And I'm painting with a broad brush here, but, like, between working at Mysterious and working for Mysterious Press and sort of being around authors, I've always found that it's the authors who have sold like a ton of books and have the sort of fame that they're looking for are the nicest fucking people on the planet. And why wouldn't they be? Because they've gotten everything that they've wanted. And it's the people who are still kind of struggling or still sort of like looking for that next big thing who sort of get that attitude and are sort of, and kind of act like, you know, like, oh, well, you know, people just don't get me or you know, I try to do this with my writing, but you know, It kind of sucks, and I kind of understand it to a degree, because when you want something really hard, you don't get it. You know, like, it's frustrating, and it can wear on you, especially in an industry that has a very long tail. But, yeah, I don't know. I feel like like guys like Michael Connelly and Lee Child, like it's really hard to write books like that. And they, people almost pass it over like, oh, whatever. They're just churning them out. It's no big deal. And like, no, like that's not easy. Like they, yes, they crack the code, but like they're sitting down and they're doing the work. And like, don't act like what they're doing is less important.
And this is exactly the argument that I have with traditional or cozy, if you prefer, where I defy any, you know, noir author to churn out the same character in probably the same town for 5 books, 10 books, 20 books, and not only have somebody go, I really, you know, I'm still reading, but go, I love this and can't wait for the next one. That's a special skill to really attach to that character, to that place, to that theme is a unique skill that I think a lot of people could learn from as far as characterization description goes. So I completely agree with you on all of that.
Well, I think with the cozies, you know, and that's a really good point because, and this is another problem that a lot of writers have where they think that they're fighting over the same readers. And it's like, you know, some person who wants to read like a light book about a cat who solves a crime is not going to read your fucking book about like some sex offender who like goes and does a bunch of sex offenses and then the fucking dark detective who just does too many drugs and beats the shit out of people, like, you know, does a tour of the underworld to like eventually beat him to death with his bare fucking hands. Like you're not playing for the same fucking crowd. You're going for two different sets of readers, but people think like, oh, you know, cozies are like totally ruining stuff. And it's like, no, like some people want to read that shit and let them, like, who fucking cares? Like you read what you want to read and let them read what they want to read and everything is fine. And we can all coexist. And
movie audiences, movies are competing for an audience and bands and comedians are competing for an audience because you're competing for the people who are going to find time to get babysitters. They're going to take time off. They're going to take an evening out. They're going to, there's money and military operation that goes into going out and doing a thing. But a book you can sit and read at home, and you can sit and read as many of them as you want at home whenever you want. So we're not competing. We've got an advantage that films don't have, comedians don't have, musicians don't have, and we should relax about that and just enjoy it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the competition thing just kind of, it makes things sort of distasteful, and it sucks when people turn it into that.
And in total agreement with you, the people that we talk about who are the most quote-unquote successful, you know, Lee Child, Michael Connelly, David Morrell, name a name, they are the first ones there to help you out, to give you advice, to give you a leg up, to give you all these positive things. At the highest levels, there is not that negativity. And so it's like, you know, and I know that you and I have talked about this, a rising tide lifts all boats, or whatever that ridiculous statement is. And the thing that I always follow it up with, because they might, you know, the next person down the line, let's say somebody's, you know, you've done really awesomely right now, Rob, and I'm so excited that you're my friend and having these positive things. And so if I'm in an anthology with you, or Jay is an anthology with you, or whoever, we go, hey, you know what? We might get more bandwidth because of your success. It's not a negative. The only outcome is a positive. So if the rising tide lifts all boats, don't be the asshole with the corkscrew.
Yeah, and you know what? That's really exciting for me. Like I feel very happy and lucky to be in the position that I am right now with the warehouse. And it also makes me really happy that there are authors that now I can, you know, it's, and I don't know who actually said it, but it's like you send the elevator back down.
Yeah.
I would like you both to know that it has started to rain. So, in case you want to feel good about the fact that
it's not raining here.
It's not raining here either.
Yeah. So all my shit talk about sitting on the beach and then drinking and having a good time, like it's all coming to an end.
I'm still tremendously jealous.
I had a fun experience a couple of weeks ago, and I was out on my bike delivering food. And I was ahead of the rain cloud. And because it was moving so slowly, I stayed ahead of the rain cloud for about 2 miles, but like 10 feet ahead of it. So I had this weird experience of being chased by rain. And where I was, it was sunny and I was sweating and it was hot. But, you know, 10 feet behind me, there was rain. And it was a really, I felt like Indiana Jones or something for a few minutes. It was amazing.
No, I think
experience.
Bill Paxton in Twitter. Or it's Twitter. In Twister.
Twitter.
Okay.
Oh, God.
Tweet.
Carrie always was like, please don't retweet me. Like, so we're cutting all of that out.
That has to stay in. That has to stay in.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a tough one. This is a tough one to say. You really dropped the ball on this one, Chantal.
I know, right? Although I did create a new thing. Bill Paxton, who's dead, in the film that was very popular, Tweeter. So.
Oh, I forgot it. I forgot he was dead. You just bummed me out.
Oh, brilliant.
Win. So we've been... Oh,
impressed, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So we've been keeping you from the beach and beautiful things and your family and more margaritas for over an hour now. Is there something that you would like to plug that's upcoming that we haven't talked about?
Well, my new book, Potter's Field, comes out July 10th. I do want to say I just read Jar of Hearts by Jennifer Hillier and Land of Shadows by Rachel Hazel-Hall, and they're both fucking fantastic, and I think people should pick those books up and read them. And the rain has stopped, so I guess now I'm going to go in the pool.
That's the perfect way to end a podcast, Rob.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. This was a lot of fun.
Okay. I still say you're insane to do this while you're on vacation, but thank you, Rob.
No, well, okay, first off, you don't say no to the Crime Friction podcast, okay? I'm not ruining my career like that.
And second,
like, we're just sitting around and bullshitting for a little while I have a drink. Like, that's mm-hmm. fine. That works for me. Crime Friction, baby. Crime Friction.
So Rob has left to go get drunk on the beach, whilst we're left behind. Sad, sober, depressed.
Regretful. We're in mourning. Rob's gone.
Yes.
He's never coming back. He might actually come back. I don't know.
But I would actually, I'll dislike him more if he actually comes back from there, because why?
Yeah, why would you come back? Oh God, what if he's dead?
If
you would also like to talk to us from tropical islands, or about guava juice, or indeed the assassination of JFK, you can contact us through Gmail at crimefriction@gmail.com.
Or on Twitter at defectivespod, or on our super fashionable MySpace page, which is myspace.com/crimefriction.
Also, please, we've had a few ratings on iTunes, which is fantastic. The people who've done it, we love you all. The check is in the mail.
We're also really excited about our summer reading, watching program that has yet to be named. And so we're hoping that you will participate in reading and watching Jaws, and then reading and watching Jurassic Park, and participating in our discussion, which are upcoming.
Yeah, if you have any thoughts as you read and as you watch about the differences between the books and the films, or, you know, silly jokes about the films, or even suggestions for titles of that podcast, send it in to us, and we will consider reading them out on the show.
Or not.
Yeah, or not. Probably not. Anyway, thanks to Rob, and I think we're done.
Yeah, hope he's alive.